Welcome to High Truths on Drugs and Addiction, where national experts bring you facts and answers. I'm your host, Dr. Onit Lev, an emergency and addiction doctor who has served at the White House and still practices on the front lines. Right here on High Truths, you will learn from experts from around the globe and around all aspects of drugs and addiction. To grow this community of information and action, I hope you give us a five-star review. Come visit me on hightruths.com to learn more about the show or download a free prescription for naloxone. Carrying naloxone for drugs is like carrying an EpiPen for allergies. Today's episode is sponsored by Physicians for Healthy Communities, a physician-led organization that educates on the science of prevention to improve public health. Visit their website to learn how they prevent substance misuse while supporting individuals, families, and communities. Go to physiciansforhealthycommunities.org. Hello again, High Truth listeners. Get ready for an integrity conversation. I'm your host, Dr. Ronit Lev. Integrity, as in product integrity. Just go to the grocery store and you'll find consumer protection information such as percent fat or sodium. You may be drawn to labels of organic or all natural. There's a lot of scrutiny in what we consume, at least in what we buy from the grocery store. We're a country obsessed with consumer protection, from our food, cosmetics, and even labels on mattresses. But what about product integrity when it comes to what you buy at a smoke shop or a marijuana store? We're so health conscious in parts of our life, and yet it all goes out the door when it comes to marijuana type products. Don, who works in youth prevention for SAY San Diego, was alarmed to find all sorts of new shroom products at a store close to a school. The shrooms, probably short for mushrooms, had colorful packaging with cartoon figures. She was outraged and wanted to know what was in those shrooms. She told me about it, and we asked law enforcement to test the products. I thought this was a great idea. We should share with the public, as well as the medical community, what people are consuming. And for various regulatory barriers, law enforcement was not able to test the products. But Dawn did not give up. She asked a cannabis drug testing lab to test the products. The results should be alarming. The mint chocolate chip shrooms, S-H-R-U-U-M-Z, contains psilocin and 4-acetoxy-DMT, analogs of phenocybin. Psilocybin is a psychoactive chemical found in various fungi and mushrooms. The Don't Drip by Dozo Mushroom Extract Gummies contain musimol. Musimol is a psychoactive chemical found in some mushrooms. What about the Stoned Cookies and Cream Amanita muscaria mushrooms? They contain Delta 8 THC, Delta 9 THC, and muscimol. I don't know what you think about product protection when it comes to these shroomy products. JAMA, the Journal of American Medical Association, was also interested in product integrity. They published a study on the accuracy of dose of edible medical cannabis products. Of the 75 products they tested from 47 different brands, only 17% were accurately labeled. A different study was published about product integrity by Dr. Thompson in the Journal of Clinical Microbiology and Infection. In this study, 20 cannabis substances from 20 different legal medical dispensaries in Northern California were tested for contaminants. All 20 samples included infectious pathogens such as E. coli, Klebsiella, and Aspergillus. These bacteria and fungi can cause serious and lethal infections, especially to immunocompromised patients. The article warned about contamination of cannabis products, and the CDC agreed. The CDC published an alert for immunocompromised patients, especially organ transplant patients, to avoid smoking marijuana. To learn more about product integrity of various cannabis and other drugs, I reached out to an expert, Josh Sweeter. Josh Sweeter studied chemistry in undergraduate and graduate school, where he noted a lack of analytical research and public understanding of cannabis. Josh founded Infinite Cal Lab with fellow chemist Dave Merrillis in 2016. Together, they made it Infinite Cal's mission to ensure only safe, quality products are allowed to be sold to consumers. To learn more about Josh Sweeter, check out the High Truth show notes. Josh Sweeter, welcome to High Truth.
Hey, thanks for having me.
I'm really excited to meet you and have this conversation and really learn about the testing products. I think that's extremely important. As an emergency physician, I want to know what people are on, and so I can make them feel better. But I think consumers also want to know. I think they want to know what they're consuming. And so this is going to be a fun conversation. And it all started when you decide to study chemistry. So tell me about that.
Yeah. So a long time ago, I used to own a construction company. And then my oldest brother was in law school and made a bet with me to I should go back to school and stop beating up my body. And I lost the bet. And I went to school, started in Eastern Washington University, got a bachelor's in chemistry, degrees in physics and biology. And I wanted to continue my education. So sold all my stuff to apply for grad school. I made it into SDSU, San Diego State University. Went there for a master's in chemistry, analytical chemistry, and then I got a joint doctoral program. I went to UCSD, where I specialized in developing ionization sources for mass spectrometers. So a lot of stuff not a lot of people know about. But
that's a lot for losing a bet to go into physics. You could have done art or PE or something.
Yeah. Well, I always enjoyed the chemistry and everything during high school and everywhere else. And I just worked for a living after high school and just kind of made my way back, though.
Wait, and this is your brother that had a bet with you?
Yeah, my oldest brother was in law school and he actually applied for me. He wrote down, started the application. And he said, if you get in, you have to go. And I'm like, all right. And I ended up
I think you owe a lot to your brother.
We're good friends.
Yeah. he knew how to get to you to change your life around. That sounds pretty awesome. And so, wait, and then the type of chemistry that you have. I was a chemistry major, but I don't ask me anything because I maybe the benzene ring, that's it. But your specialty, did your PhD on was the hardware of a mass spectrometer. Can you explain that to me?
Analytical chemistry is kind of the quantitation qualification of compounds in any kind of matrix. Mm-hmm. And then I specialize in the hardware. So the instruments people use to do the quantification. So mostly a lot of people are using mass spectrometers. So a focus of mine was hardware mass spectroscopy. And I built mass specs, designed them, fixed them, did everything to them. And then I was developing novel ionization sources. Ionization sources is the way you create ions for the mass spectrometer to kind of accept it or redo a reading. And so I would work on projects doing that. And then, I don't know, just something I enjoyed. It's like a very niche, you say chemistry gets small. You say analytical chemistry, even smaller. You go to mass spec, even smaller. Hardware mass spec, you keep whittling down to these degrees. And that's what a lot of times like PhDs, we get so hyper-focused in one thing. But overall, I had a lot of OEs for analytical chemistry and knowing and the knowledge of that. I've taught for over the years, did a lot of things. It's just a passion of mine is learning about the analytical chemistry and the different techniques we can do to solve the problems that were presented.
That's fascinating. And then from that, you didn't just go from construction to being an academician. You also went to being an entrepreneur.
Yeah. So I finished up there and there was a new testing. I always wanted to open my own lab because I didn't want to work for someone else. And I had the opportunity, me and a business partner, Dave Marilius, he graduated about 6 months before or 8 months before I did. And he was still around, kind of postdocing and helping out some lab stuff. And I was presenting him an opportunity that I thought was great. I think we should open a analytical lab. And there's a lot of cannabis and hemp testing in California going on. And they're missing the key scientist. This is over about a decade ago or so. And a lot of people saw going into a cannabis industry, even if it's chemistry or the science side or the analytical side, was throwing away your degree. I didn't believe that. I believe public safety is what people need. But that's what kind of the analytical chemistry drive I have is not necessarily working for the clients that pay me. I'm working for the public to ensure products are safe or accurate in making it to them. So the cannabis and hemp space was a mess, in my opinion, still is, but I'm still working at it. I'm still here. I mean, this industry, 10 years is like you're a dinosaur, but it's not that long. But we worked on that, kind of grew the company in California and San Diego, started a 1,200 square foot lab with two guys and a dream and $10,000 each. And now we have 32,000 square feet in San Diego, another 10,000 square feet in Michigan of lab space. We do various things from cannabis and hemp to just mushroom stuff and different types of analytes. I do DOD work, Department of Defense, do analytical water testing for state municipalities, cities, a lot of different projects. So we kind of diversified into a lot of the safety testing because all this stuff is very interesting to me. And I have a great people surrounded by us, a lot of passionate people about analytical chemistry and protecting public safety, not just like making money. And that's a great part about being someone like me is I own the company, so I probably spend more money on stuff I shouldn't. But if I think it's useful or something that's going to be good, I buy all the cool new toys and analytical equipment we need.
Right. And it sounds like you love those toys.
Yeah. That's what this project we're going to talk about kind of got me. I got some really expensive new toys that are like top notch for exploratory research. And that's what brought me to this too.
That's fascinating. I want to explore a little more, like, what hole did you feel like that was missing? You said that you saw an industry that was broken and you wanted to fix it. What when you started this, did you have a personal relationship with marijuana and hemp products, or did you see, what did you see that was broken that you wanted to do?
I've known about marijuana and hemp growing up and people consuming it. And I think there was always a medical use for it. And a lot of people use that instead of other products and they get a lot of great effects from it or great benefits from using it. And it was always illegal. And I saw it coming into a legal market. So California has had med for a long time. I mean, when I first started the company, we would go knock on the med doors and tell them to test their cannabis to make sure it's safe for consumption. And then everyone would tell us to get out. But what the holes I was talking about is the product that I've always seen this industry as a beneficial industry. I think it should be out there and it should be regulated and it should be made sure that people are safe. If someone wants to consume cannabis or hemp in any industry, they should not get a negative health effect because they're consuming a contaminated product. And that's what our large line of defense is for the public, is to make sure contaminated products are not making it to shelves. So if someone gets an adverse health effect, it doesn't come back and say, hey, you smoke cannabis in California in this year and they have an adverse health effect. And it wasn't actually from cannabis, but it was from a contaminant on cannabis. And that's what we've been working on and why I said there was a hole in it. I mean, I've seen more data and collected more data than a lot of people in the world on this. And there's a lot of contaminated product and a lot of falsification in labs and labs in this. A lot of why I said they need scientists when I first started and still to this day is people saw laboratories as businesses. And I know that it is a business, but at the same time, you should have some kind of passion. You shouldn't be, you know, a random business major starting an analytical chemistry laboratory with no background. And then, you know, you hit a button and it says passing results or gives results people want. And then it's similar to the other things, you know, then guess what? You get paid, you get money. And then that's their benefit. It's not, actually, it's a failing sample. I shouldn't have passed that. And that's where the kind of differences come between a lot of this stuff. And this is the regulatory industry. Cannabis and hemp around the United States has all sorts of problems like this with lab fraud and other things. And then in other industries, we see that as well. Inaccurate testing can create major problems for people down the line. And so that's kind of the passion I kind of brought into it.
So your mission, like that, is, you know, for your lab is to ensure only safe and quality drugs are available. And I wonder if safe and quality is the same thing as I would think of as a physician or as you would as a chemist or analytical chemist thinks of. So what is considered safe? So for me, safe is, well, you can develop an addiction. You can have a psychotic break. You can drive and kill someone because you're high. Like, what? But I think, chemically speaking, you may think of safe and quality differently.
Yeah. So those things they kind of go hand in hand too. So like, even if you say safety, so like on a product, it gives you a concentration. Even if it's, you know, a painkiller. What if those painkillers were 10 times stronger sometimes and 10 times less strong? And people are taking them, they're like, oh, I can drive when I eat my 5 milligrams. But one time they get the pill and they're eating 50 milligrams. That could be a problem. So like that even transcends safety. And so when I say safe, I mean safe to even like a standard of potency or how potent something is or how much compound is in there. That's safe. And then when I also say safety, it's the contaminants. So like in the pharmaceutical world, things are developed and that there's a lot of screening protocols for contaminants possibly that would cause adverse health effects. In these other industries, that can be skipped. And like, I'll go back to the cannabis hemp industry. If they're spraying pesticides on material and the pesticides are known carcinogens, and then people are inhaling the known carcinogens, what is going to happen to that person? They're going to end up getting cancer one day. And it's not necessarily from that. So the safety of the product is an aspect, making sure it's a product to consume for human consumption. Even those guidelines, heavy metals, the microbacteria. There's a lot of things that we look at in food safety that are a very similar thing. And that's why when I say the word safe in that manner.
Wow, that's fascinating. I agree with that. I'm wondering if that exists. Like, can you dependably go to a dispensary and know that that product doesn't have those pesticides?
You can if you use trusted brands and products. So what do I mean by that? There's a lot of people in even a lot of these industries that go above and beyond. Above and beyond testing, above and beyond making sure they have an insured product. And then there's a lot of companies that go the opposite direction. They find a lab that'll commit fraud, or they purposely switch stuff out, or they're doing things unknowingly and willingly to just put product on the shelf so they can make a few more dollars. So like I said, even in the legal cannabis industry, you have the great actors that are doing things right, and they are hurting because it costs more money to do things right, as everyone knows. And you have the people just skating the line and doing things through the back door that are creating contaminated products.
How do you know what a trusted brand is?
That's the hard part. It's the people that are doing it and present the data to them. So I know there's a lot of there can be misconceptions on who's trusted and who's not, and everyone's going to say they're trusted. It's going to be, I wish there was a better way to do it. I'm a third party testing lab, so I don't necessarily promote the people that I know are doing it right, because that's a conflict of interest to me. I mean, people might think I'm wrong for doing that, but I'll tell you this, there's people out there doing it right. There's public information. The people in the industry, or if you were to ask the shop people, they normally know. The other ways they can do it is looking at COAs, and that's a big ask for a general public to do it. But that's why I strive.
What's COA?
I have to say a COA, certificate of analysis. So like most products being sold in the industries have certificate analysis, and they could skip things like the hemp industry. Most certificate analysis is potency analysis only. They don't screen for pesticides or anything else. And I have some theories on a lot of what the hemp industry of today is just the failed stuff in the cannabis industry.
It's not even hemp anymore, right? It's not.
That's a whole talk. We could spend probably 4 hours on that conversation.
Right. Crazy.
But I mean, so the trusted brands, there are people out there doing it right. And they have been, they've been putting themselves doing it right. And then you would hope like a regulatory body, like if we're going to sit in California, the Department of the DCC, Department of Cannabis Control, is regulating this stuff and checking and regulating their testing lab.
Isn't it their job to let consumers know what's trusted and what's not?
Yeah. That is true. I mean, I don't know if you read an article in the LA Times recently about pesticide contamination in the state of California. That was a big paper in the LA Times recently, and there's been a few follow-ups on that. It's just the fact that it should be questioned, that we should be scrutinizing what's going on more and not just trusting everyone's word for it.
Well, but that's the point, is we had to go to the LA Times to get an investigative reporter to tell us that we have a, you know, multi-million dollar agency that's paid to do that, right?
I 100% guarantee. I mean, before that LA Times paper came out, the DCC spent $5 million on a campaign telling everyone cannabis is safe on their shelves. It's a little alarming always the amount of money that's wasted. There's $13.8 million to set up a testing laboratory to test labs in California, and it's still not completed. If they gave me $1 million, I would have had it running 5 years ago and up and running beautifully. I mean, I don't know. It's sometimes just state money. I kind of wish things move faster. I'm always willing to help. I'm not trying to start conflicts with state regulators or anyone else. They know I'm out there to do the right thing and to continue this industry forward, so we don't get adverse health effects and blaming cannabis, people are around for their kids. They didn't smoke legal cannabis or legal hemp, and then, you know, they're dying of cancer at 40 because they did, and then their kids aren't around for their children. This is the stuff that really drives me, and that's what makes me so passionate about this stuff. And I've kind of stepped in the limelight of all this stuff with cannabis and hemp and been public about it for the last couple of years now. I've always been on the back end doing this and working with regulators and states and telling kind of what's going on and informing on how bad systems are. and just to improve it. It's not to pick on anyone. It's not to pick on a producer or anything like that. It's to make sure the public is getting a safe product. And that's what kind of we always go to is, it doesn't matter if my mom grew cannabis, she doesn't. If she did and she tested it and it failed in my lab, guess what? It would fail at my lab. And that's the reality. And that's the scary part in this industry. A lot of people got pushed up against the wall financially. And then, you know, stuff started going downhill on that matter.
All right. So I want to ask you about a lab. How do people know if it's a good lab or a bad lab? Like, is there a way to tell? I mean, so the state of California, for example, or state of Michigan, so you're there, they yeah. send products to govern them and to test them. And people say, oh, yeah, our products get tested. But you said there's a lot of cheating out there. So are governments being cheated as well as the consumers?
Yeah. I mean, so the governments are getting lied to. They're not involved in the testing. They're involved in regulating the testing. So they should do a better job at regulating the testing industries and not always trusting. I feel like a lot of this industry, the bus started down the road and they're like, oh, yeah, we should test the product. Oh, man. Oh, we should regulate testing. Oh, we're going down the road. It's going fast. There's a lot of product on the shelf. Oh, testing is going to happen. We got two staff members to control 20 labs. It's not happening. So like, it's kind of like a big game of catch up. And I think it's coming online. And how do you tell who's a trusted lab versus not trusted? I mean, the industry knows, and I love it when I hear people say they don't or they never knew. I've been on too many emails, too many calls. I've been in the industry for a decade. I know everyone. Everyone knows this is a small industry. I mean, there used to be lists going around if you wanted to pass samples. This is the five labs you go to or this or that. They're still out there. And there's back-end deals getting done. So what's a trusted lab? I mean, honestly, if I was a producer, you should do it like every other industry does. You should be checking the lab's credentials. You should be scrutinizing your lab. You should be internally testing your lab. You should be qualifying your labs. You should be asking your labs for SOPs. This is what normal industries do. It's not, hey, look, I send the lab, this lab's samples, they fail. I send it to this one, they pass. I'm going to choose the second one because they passed there. That's not a qualifying lab. That's how you disqualify labs. So like that's a big ask.
Sounds like my husband trying to get the old Jeep to get smog tested to pass the certificate.
He just go to enough places to get it done. I know a couple.
Drive it around for a while.
I might have been guilty of that one day, but I had a 17 for it. But
So yesterday I was on a webinar with people from the state of Michigan. And I was actually really impressed with the head of their equivalent of Cannabis Control Board from Michigan.
Brian Hanna?
Yes. So he spoke and he talked about the fraud that's going on in testing. And he was advocating, it'll be interesting what you think of this. He was saying that's why the state of Michigan should own its own lab. What do you think?
100%. 100%. I backed him on this for a long time. They should. All states should have their own internal testing lab. And it's not to test the product that's being produced by the producers. It's to check the labs and also further the industry. So what I mean by that is labs should be looking ahead and the internal testing labs and testing things that aren't on the list or making sure product consumers are getting the right product or safe. They should be testing their labs. They should be testing the system. So I've supported the state of Michigan to have a testing lab. Claire Patterson was named the director of that lab. I think she can do a great job with it if she does what she's supposed to do. And I think she will. I'm not saying she won't. It's going further then. So in Michigan, there's
so it doesn't put you out of business by them states having the lab, right? They're just the quality control piece.
They're a quality control piece. So like, think about it. If a state wanted to take action against a producer that had a failing sample on a shelf because this lab passed it and this lab failed it. What do they do? How do you get legally, you probably need an internal state lab to test that, to make that judgment call or to check a system. They're in no way going to be taking the role of testing all the samples. Their laboratory is teeny. It's not big enough in the first place. It's to do a quality control check and to figure out anything that's going on. At some point, if you have laboratories in any state, it's not just Michigan, let's say you have five labs, three of which give you one answer, two of which give you a different answer, who's right? You know, if they're diversely enough of an answer, that's what's happening in the cannabis industry right now. So right now they need the laboratories just to settle that dispute. Like they internally can use their scientists' validated method, and now they can quality control check the labs as well as the producers. And then the thing expanding the testing regulations or making sure the product is safe is important. I mean, like that's what I was talking about. Like in Michigan, there's 58 pesticides, I think, on the list right now. I could be wrong by a couple. I work in a lot of states and do a lot of things. But who says there's not, who says the producers out there didn't see the list of 58 5 years ago and said, all right, let me choose one of these other 5,000 that you're not scanning for. So the scary part about analytical chemistry, when we do these things, we end up developing a method to look for like a list of 58 analytes. And guess what we do? We put our blinders on. We say, I'm looking for these 58. I have to look low. You get sensitivity, and what we need to do, you look for these 58 compounds. You ignore everything else, right? So when you do that, what happens if, let's say, another pesticide was being used, it's not on your list at very high concentrations? It'll make it through the system. So what I'm saying is, like, labs that are internal labs, they should be doing these large screening sets. I just did this in the state of California. I have 380 pesticides being screened for instead of 66.
Wow.
It's why I did that. It's because I've been saying this for years and no one wanted to do this. As in, no, not all of the industry wanted to do it. State government is like, yeah, this is not what we're regulating. Well, is that really consumer safety then? Is this what we're here for? Is public health? Or are we here to pass things onto shelves and turn a blind eye? So I've been working with the various people around the industry that are very interested in this. And you start to see things. I mean, there's one pesticide showing up at a very high level at about approximately 20% of the product on the shelf.
That's what is not that?
A listed pesticide.
What is it?
Pimetrazine.
Okay. Pimetrazine.
It's a level 2 act toxicity, likely human carcinogen, regulated in the EU at 20 parts per billion in all food products. In the US, it's regulated at various other food products. But overall, you have to be approved for use of a commercial pesticide by someone like the CDPR, which is the California Department of Pesticide Regulation, to use it. They have a very handy handout and website to go through if you grow cannabis and hemp, what pesticides you're commercially allowed to spray on. And the answer is hardly anything, because nothing is approved for commercial use on cannabis. And that's how pesticides are normally used. You have to be approved for use on a specific product, because that's where we look at health effects. If not, this can go backwards and horribly very wrong very quickly. And that's why we have things like Department of Pesticide Controls and federal regulation on this stuff. One thing I would talk about.
But how do you know that where you're buying, even a medical dispensary is not using that? I mean, they're just buying marijuana, and they're not regulating the grows. They're just buying the stuff. So, and if everybody's using these pesticides, what is the name again?
Pimetrazine.
Pimetrazine. Okay. So, if that's everybody's using this, what's that?
That's just one of them. That's the highest one I've screened so far. This is hundreds of samples of products being sold on shelves. So it's not just me claiming this. I don't make claims. I look at data and make decisions on what I'm seeing. So that number is not made up. And what I'm saying, 20% is approximately over one part per million, which would be mostly regulated at any pesticide on any cannabis product. How does anyone know, or how do the dispensaries know? They don't know. And this is what I've been trying to talk to people about for a long time, is like, we have to do these things. And this is what I'm saying the state lab should be doing. It shouldn't be me doing it. Why? I make no money on this. I spend all my money on doing things like this to protect public safety. And then people will make claims like, oh, no, he's just trying to make money. If I was trying to make money, I would have shut up and forged my data.
That's right. That's right. And you wouldn't be spending your money on extra toys and tests that you don't need to.
So this is what the state lab should be doing. You can do this kind of stuff. You develop these large lists. You do the screening protocols. You know, in California, I can say there's 5 or 6 pesticides that should be immediately added to the list right now that we are scanning for because of the number of samples containing it.
So, okay. So your screen, let's talk about what you're testing for. Let's talk about like your toys and what they're finding. Pesticides is one of them, right? And you said you're finding that a lot. Are there any good actors?
Yes.
Okay. But you wouldn't know as a consumer who's good and who's not.
Brogarden, I've worked with them for years. They've been screening larger lists and doing things correctly.
Who's that?
Holding a hard line on doing things correctly. I probably, like I said, I don't like to promote clients, but I'm not promoting them. You ask a question, I'm answering.
All right. What are they called?
Brogarden.
And that's is that a dispensary?
No, it's a large production company. They produce most of the a lot of concentrates and things heavily consumed in the cannabis industry. It's called Raw Garden.
Raw Garden. So they, when you test Raw Garden stuff, they don't have pesticides.
Nope. They've been on the extended list, and they've been working towards that kind of stuff. And they, and if they did, they would pull it off the shelf, and they don't sell it. So
let me ask you something I've always been curious about. The pesticides, do you find that just in the flower, or do you find it sometimes in the edibles too?
You'll find it in everything. So you'll find it from everything from edible, the concentrates to flower. Over the years in the state of California, I'll say it's gotten better. When we look at the list of 66 pesticides we screen, okay, it's gotten better. I mean, in 2018, I did some studies and surveys where I think it was upward of 80% were failing for the list, yeah, being sold on shelves. So, and people know this, and it's just, it was fraud. Other various reasons why, I'm not going to go into that. But it's gotten better over the years, but it's still not perfect. And I'm not asking for perfection, but we should definitely take that in consideration, that this is the stuff that we know, because there is EPA research out there that say this is going to be harmful and contaminate. Unless the industry wants to stick a pack on their packaging causes cancer and negative health effects, like this other companies that were very big called cigarettes or tobacco did. Yeah. And that's why they gave up on fighting pesticide bites. A lot of people talk about pesticide regulations in tobacco products. There really isn't too many, but there was a lot of IP being done by them to look how long people would last. So it would be pesticides. And then there's also some things about that they gave up the fight in legislation about pesticide limits in tobacco products, because they already wrote on it causes cancer and negative health effects. So if you do that, you can have pesticides in your product.
But wait, the tobacco, and I don't know the answer to this, the tobacco plant by itself without any pesticide, if there is such a thing, does not cause cancer.
So I'm not saying that, but if you stick on it,
you don't need a test, and then you're done.
You don't have to, the other stuff doesn't matter. Got it. Oh yeah, you have one thing that causes cancer and negative health effects, add another one.
Because we're seeing that now with cannabis. We're seeing that cannabis is associated. There's just an article I think came out this week with head and neck cancer, and people are like, oh my gosh. And it's like, it's not surprising. If you smoke something, it's gonna cause cancer here, just like it does with tobacco. Whether it's, I imagine, you know, we say that the same carcinogens that occur in tobacco occur in cannabis.
But this is talking to a medical professional here, but I always think it's hard when you're trying to try to trace back what caused the negative health effect or the cancer. Let's just stick with, is it the cannabis? Is it the tobacco? Was it the thing heavily sprayed on the tobacco? Was it the heavy metals that are coming out in the tobacco? You understand what I'm saying? If there's 10 things that could cause it, how do we say it's this exactly?
But it's probably like tobacco, where at some point you're like, you know, either you fix the industry, you can know the answer, yeah, or just like you said, we've had medical cannabis now in California for 25, how many years, like a long time, and you haven't fixed it. So you're not gonna know the answer. So the bottom line is, we already like down the road with the cancer statistics.
I know that's what I've been trying to tell people. It's like, you fix the industry now. And that's why I do these things like the extended testing and making sure things are safe. And we look at other analysis too and analyze. And we want to, I personally have made my goal that this industry doesn't die because, and we're going to blame it for negative health effects if it's not justly caused.
Right.
You understand what I'm saying? Like,
yeah, I hear you. You're trying to do the right thing, but you know, big marijuana is not necessarily following. So they're following the money.
There are operators in this industry that are following and have been following.
Yeah.
They have the same like thought process. They don't want to poison their consumers. They believe in cannabis and as a medicine, and don't want to have these other contaminants on their cannabis material. And they've done a lot of work not to.
Or even if it's not a medicine, if it's recreational, like tobacco, they also still don't want to have that.
But I mean, even recreational, I feel like a lot of people use recreational cannabis as some kind of medicine. You understand what I'm saying? They're using it for some reason, and it's self-diagnosing medicine.
I see what you're saying, but that's where, as a doctor, I have a problem with that. Because for me to prescribe a medicine, right, I had to go through medical school and residency and certification. And if I don't document and I don't have a risk benefit, I would lose my license. That doesn't exist with medical cannabis.
No, not at all.
Yeah.
I mean, you call someone and say your back aches, and they'll get you medical cannabis.
Right. So that's what people, I know what you're saying. You're saying people are self-medicating themselves, but yeah, that I have trouble with that, because then that destroys my field. Right. But I do understand what you're saying. Okay. So you're testing for pesticides and these other contaminants. That's awesome. And you do more than what the state requires because you know that it's out there and you're finding it. What about, we're talking about potencies. So we're talking about also like your, so contaminants is your mission on quality. I wonder if potency is your mission on safety, because like you said, okay, I took one Vicodin versus taking 10 Vicodins. That's a little different, right? And you're testing some of these products that are, right, like 90% THC. Like, who said that's safe?
So like the concentrates will get up to that is 90% THC, and then it became almost, this industry also has inflated numbers over the years because one thing sells higher than the other. Oh, look, my flower has 20%. Now it has 30%. Now it has 40%. Yeah. And then it's a selling tactic. And then it's just fraud and consumer fraud. That's not necessarily going to hurt people, consumer fraud for mislabeling. But at the same time, like going back to like, this is more prevalent, I would say, in the hemp industry, where you can buy products that are a hodgepodge of air quote cannabinoids, but some of them are, and some of them are just chemicals we call cannabinoids now, I feel like. They never were found on any kind of cannabis or hemp plant. They're just synthetically made in laboratories and then put on.
Are you talking about like the Delta 8 and Delta 10 and the
Delta 10, HHC, anything like that? I mean, and then this is a whole conversation, but a lot of these products we kind of talked about, people making the hospitals, like kids make it into the hospitals, they get these gummies and they're like, oh, I'm gonna eat five of them. Because last time I ate two of them, they didn't do anything. And it's mislabeled so far. And they throw a hodgepodge of cannabinoids in it and they call it hemp compliant. And then the people are getting overdosing on it and it's too much. It's a little scary, in my opinion. The hemp industry is a mess. And also, in my opinion, there are, again, good operators, but it's very few and far between. And then the good operators are fighting the battle of losing to the bad operators because they can't financially do things right. So what I mean by that is like the whole hemp industry with synthetic cannabinoids. I'm going to say synthetic cannabinoids. And I know there's a conversation that that's old, you know, HHC or the old synthetic ones back in the 90s. But it's just a synthetic production of a cannabinoid. So even if you're taking CBD and doing a Delta 9 conversion or a Delta 8 conversion, when you do that synthetic conversion or chemical conversion, you create things. You use chemicals to do production. Most of the people are not screening for the chemicals they use for production. So what I mean by that, they'll screen it against the cannabis residual solvent list. But again, that's what, 15 solvents that they can use, and there's 50 other solvents that are commercially used to do the synthesis. So they don't even check to see if that the solvents are used during that production. Secondly, they don't look at any kind of purity. They don't look at the purity of their analyte. So if they're going to make, let's say, CBD and Delta-9 THC, well, technically, Delta-9 THC in marijuana is negative trans Delta-9 THC. I know I'm saying a lot, and people might be confused, but Delta-9 THC comes in four flavors you can kind of think about. There's four different enantiomers. There's cis enantiomers and trans enantiomers. And those things, when we look at it, if you look at marijuana, you're getting all one type. So if you do a synthetic conversion from CBD to Delta-9, you should be looking at your purity of negative trans Delta-9. No one does this because it's very hard to do. And you get a racemic mixture of cis and trans. But the third thing is you also create things called byproducts. Byproducts are made during synthetic production of chemicals that are not intended. And this is chemistry, basic chemistry. We all know as chemists, we're not as good as plants. That's why you have a thing called natural chemistry, where we try to mimic plants' productions of things. And we can't do it. And so what happens is they create all these byproducts that are never found in a plant, right? And normally what happens in like a pharma company or FDA regulated thing, guess what? If you can't create enough pure enough of a single analyte product or single compound product, you must do safety and efficacy studies on the byproducts. Right now, the hemp industry is doing safety and efficacy studies with the rat experiment with the human population. 100%.
That's exactly what I say. I said, though, this has not been, these drugs have not been tested in rats. We are the rats.
Yep, right now we are. And I have a method to determine if your Delta-9 THC came from marijuana, hemp, or synthetically produced. And I have that approved with an AOAC Appendix K validation in the state of Michigan. It was the first state to accept my validation. I've tried in states, and I've been sharing this method with a lot of state regulators because it's important. It's important to see that we are creating byproducts and we're selling it to people to inhale. And this is like, I'm not saying no one in the world can say this is 100% unsafe, but it's never the onus of someone to prove it's unsafe first. It's the onus of a producer to prove it's safe for the public to consume
before. Well, you're like the first person I've heard say that in the industry, because it's not, that's not the way the world is working.
That's not the way the world is working in the cannabis industry. We call it cannabis. But go back to pharma. Tell pharma to do it. Would they do that? Would pharma make a drug and have a, like 10% byproducts or 60 different byproducts in it and sell it to the general population?
But that's because they're regulated under the FDA, very scrutin, you know, and people may say they like or dislike the FDA, but that's our gold standard, right? As a physician, I can't, that's the only thing that I can rely on. If that goes away, then my profession goes away.
Yeah, but then why do we say because they made Delta 9 THC synthetically, it shouldn't be regulated by the FDA? It's still a compound being synthetically made with the same problems you would get during the synthetic chemistry of any pharmaceutical.
So you think that the FDA should be regulating all these products?
For synthetic production of cannabinoids, 100% yes.
But their catch 22 is like, well, this is federally illegal, so we shouldn't be regulating this.
I've sat at the table with the USDA and the FDA who do this. It's their job to regulate.
Right. They both point to Congress. It's like, we're not fixing this. You created the stupid law.
They need to decide who does it.
Right.
Yeah. But if we can't sit, I really hope that we don't look back at this in 10 years and be like, man, we really shouldn't cut the corner on that. Now we have a lot of negative health effects. And then we can never trace it back, because you know the sad part is these products are being sold in the cannabis industry. So they take the CBD to Delta 9 THC and put it into the cannabis industry and sell it as legal cannabis, which it's not, because it's synthetically produced. So guess what? Let's say those byproducts that I'm talking about, which I have categorized, there's universities like Ole Miss does a lot of work on this. Other universities that I work with and talk to have done work on this, and we're starting to categorize and isolate these compounds, and we're figuring out what they are. And then there are people going to be doing safety and efficacy studies on these byproducts. And if that turns out bad and it's all soaked into the cannabis industry, who's going to be blamed? No one's going to have a commercial said, "Did you in the state of Michigan, did you smoke synthetically derived Delta 9 in the legal cannabis system?" No, they're going to say, "Did you smoke cannabis in the state of Michigan?" That's all it is. And then you're going to get the wrong blame. This is my point with the pesticides and everything else. The industry could potentially just be going straight into the wall, and then we kill an industry that had potential good to it because we had to cut corners. And the sad part about the synthetic stuff is the producers are saving like 10 cents a vape cart to produce it at. So you're going to save yourself 10 cents to possibly harm the public?
But, I did a podcast with Dr. El Soli, the guy who makes cannabis to sell for research, right? And he was telling me, in order for his purity and lack of contamination, for him to be able to sell it to researchers, it has to be very clean and scrutinized. That's expensive and not easy to do.
So that's the big difference. This is what happens. So they... all these, like El Sole or anyone else doing this production. I know someone else that does it, Everett. He's been doing it for 20 years. He does it for research purposes and standards and stuff like that. So the production is the same method what the industry is doing. They do it this crude way by taking CBD and then doing the isolate, then or CBD and doing this conversion to Delta 9, or let's just stick with that one. We can go to other cannabinoids too. But that's the cheap step. You think that's the 1% of the cost of the production for this stuff. The 99% of the cost of production is what you just said. It's when you have to do the cleanup. You can create this dirty material. The cleanup step is the hard part. So example, you can create this, let's just stick with Delta 9 synthetic conversion from CBD. You can make it for about $200 a liter, $200 a 1,000 grams, 200 to 300. If you do the cleanup, you go to $20,000. So that right now, the industry is just skipping the expensive step to make it safe. Yeah. Because then it's no longer cost effective for someone to use that material in a legal market where you can buy extracted marijuana or extracted marijuana Delta 9 THC for $2,000 a kilo. Do you understand what I'm saying?
Yeah. So, but there's no incentive for you to buy the expensive stuff.
Nope. So the incentive is to not do the cleanup like El Soli is doing or anyone else doing it, because then it just becomes not financially.
Would it be fair to say that if you walk into a dispensary, chances are whatever you're buying did not go through the cleanup?
If it is synthetic. So the last round of study I did in the state of Michigan on concentrates on the legal shelf, 38% were synthetic. in the state of Michigan. Brian Hanna knows that.
So that so that's the hemp products, right? But what if I go, what about if I go?
No, that's the cannabis products.
Oh.
That is the cannabis thought products sold in the cannabis legal stores, not hemp products. We can go to the hemp products, but that's a lot higher. So if I walk into a legal cannabis dispensary in the state of Michigan, from my last study of over 50, 66 brands with multiple SKUs from each,
yeah,
38% contain synthetic Delta 9. Legal cannabis stores in the state of Michigan.
Is that just the edible products?
No, this is vaporizers.
Oh, vaporizer. Okay.
So it's going to be the worst way to consume something. Right.
The chances are, if you're buying a vape product, you're buying some crap.
There's 38% chance. The last study, this is not that long ago.
What about the plain old number one consumer product that's sold is just flour? What about flour?
So flour that... As far as what's part of
it? Contaminants or cleanup or... Because that's what El Soli is selling. He's not selling vapes and edibles. He's selling joints, so pure flower. And he spends the extra time to clean that up to make sure that doesn't have any of the byproducts.
So I saw one of his research just came out chopping shelves around the country for flower and looking at the THC concentration or the potency, some people call it, but cannabinoid concentration. And it was vastly different from what was being sold. So it goes back to that thing where we're talking about you're buying something incorrectly on the numbers. That's a problem. That's a big problem with cannabis flower. Now the purity or the cleanliness of it from pesticides, yeah. That's studies that we've done too. I mean, over the years, it's gotten better. You still have stuff that passes through. If you do things like standard pesticide lists, not just taking to the state that you're regulated in, you end up finding a lot more fails. But it's not all bad. It's a lot cleaner. Not a lot cleaner. It's just, again, it depends on the brand. It depends on what's going on with
it. So I think the medical community is also just really misinformed. I've heard some physicians who will remain nameless, but they'll treat patients who have cannabis hyperemesis syndrome. That's usually, not always, but usually from smoked products. And they'll say, oh, you know what? Why don't you just stop smoking and use a gummy instead? And I'm thinking, ugh, that's more potent. And I wasn't able to answer the question about, well, you don't have the contaminants, but you're telling me that you can
have. Edible products are going to have a lot less contaminants. I mean, edible product, I wouldn't say is more potent either. Because if you look at it a relative thing, let's say you eat one edible, you get 10 milligrams of THC. Let's say you take flour, which is 20% THC. If you were to smoke a gram of that, that's 200 milligrams of THC, right? So if you smoked a gram of flour, you've ingested 10 times more than you would have by eating it. Or 20 times, excuse me.
Right.
Does that make sense?
Yeah. Dose
to but then there's a lot of caveats to it. You inhale a cannabis product, you don't absorb it all. If you blow it out directly, you absorb a lot less. If you hold a cannabis marijuana hidden longer, it exponentially absorbs. There's like a lot of things to play at that. So those aren't hard numbers. I'm just kind of going through.
Right. When you smoke, you kind of self-regulate your high. You can. But when you eat, you can't.
You eat it and your gut... You eat it, and then that's where you're going. There's no way back, I guess. You know what I mean? And it's a longer-lasting thing. I agree with what you're saying. I wouldn't say it's more unsafe than smoking joints, especially the stuff that's sold on the market today with you're coated with concentrates and everything else. I mean, people can smoke 5 puffs of those and get more high. It doesn't last as long, let's say. But
right. But you won't get the pulmonary effects from edibles, right? But you will get some of the cancer. I don't. The other thing is the other impurities. Like we tell, this is very clear. This is from the CDC. We tell people who are immunocompromised, especially organ transplant patients, not to smoke cannabis products because nearly 100% of them have fungus and other contaminants. Yeah. Now, the oncologists clearly say that to their patients, but they don't go so far as saying not to use the edibles because they don't know that.
Yeah, so the edibles too. So when you look at the edibles, you can kind of think about, and this is maybe a wrong way to look at it, but the solution to pollution is dilution. You understand what I'm saying?
The solution to the pollution is the
solution to pollution is dilution.
Dilution.
So you get this thing to pass, let's say it had pesticides in the flour. And then, like I said, a gram of flour, 200 milligrams of THC, well, divide now that pesticide by 20 because you're only putting 10 milligrams in one edible. Do you understand what I'm saying? So when you concentrate the pesticides out, they come through the THC just the same manner.
So you're saying in the flower, those fungal and E. coli are a lot more concentrated than in the edibles.
It's not
so because they're diluted.
To take flour, THC, and then put it into an edible, you're going to go through some kind of extraction process. Mm-hmm. Most extraction process, I'm not going to say all, because you can do something weird. You're going to remove any kind of fungal, you're going to kill the microbial load, because a lot of times you heat it up extremely hot and you're passing it through. There's a lot of cleanup and there's a lot of ethanol used. So you kill microbes, you kill bacteria during the process of extraction. So then when you create that concentrate, the THC concentrate, that's normally removed of any kind of microbial contamination. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Because the processing of it, and then you're going to concentrate things like contaminants, like pesticides, toxic metals, and some other things more. But then if you put it into an edible, it's so small amount, and that's the difference. Then instead of inhaling, yeah.
I get it.
Not promoting edibles, by the way.
But it's not 100% safe. Again, something the medical community, I think, and the public should know about. The other thing that I definitely see, and it's talked about, is like the chocolate chip effect in edibles. So like I had a patient who, you know, for 2 years has been using these gummies for fibromyalgia and hadn't done anything for her. Then she went and ends up in the emergency department, passed out, cracked her head open, needed a lot of stitches and CAT scan and everything else. And she was going to really have a headache now. But I asked her, like, but I've been using this forever. And I said, well, was this a new batch? And she said, yes. And it's like, okay, the chocolate chip effect is that the whole bag of gummies could have nothing in it. And that one gummy could have all the THC in it. And are you able to, do you test for that? Or I saw the picture in the LA Times where you kind of like mix it up because it's not as easy to test the chocolates and the candies.
So okay, there used to be a test in California. In Michigan, it's still out there. It's called the homogeneity test. Yeah. So like we would go acquire one product, let's say one bag of gummies, or you take two gummies, and every gummy you take it out and you test it. Or you take a chocolate bar and slice it how it's directed, and you take each piece and you test it, and you make sure you have a plus or minus 10% of the active ingredient in the dosage.
Okay.
And to pass that, each manufacturer has to prove on SKUs every year, I believe in Michigan now, it's kind of changed over time, that you have to do that so that you make sure it's being done. And I'll say this, edible manufacturing has, over the last 5 years, has gone from day night to day. You know what I mean? Day to night. It's totally different. They're a lot more homogenous, but a long time ago, I remember this very thing happening. You'd see production of these edibles, and like one of them would be 40, one of them would be 10, one of them would be 2. But now there's a lot of people doing it, a lot more consistency. And it's not required in the state of California, but good operators are doing those things and making sure they do create homogenous edibles everywhere.
That just blows my mind. Like, it's not required in California. Like, hello, isn't that your job?
They took that away some years ago. They had it originally, homogeneity on all edibles, and then it went away. I think sometimes that's just the lobbying, people that want to spend extra money. And I mean, after some of the companies do get it down and right, and they're doing it, and they learn the new method to do it, they're always going to more than less do it or create a homogenous. And it should be on the onus of the producer to make sure it's done. I mean, this is also why like the cannabis beverages died in the beginning. The cannabis beverages came out, you know, 2015, some 2016. They were a small market, and the homogeneity or the cans would range from 10 milligrams or 5 milligrams, and they would be labeled at 10, then they would have a quarter of a milligram. So it was all over the place because of just production problems and then people not fixing it. Now you see a lot more consistency in that market and people learning how to do it. It just takes time, if that makes sense. But that's the problem that you see a lot of times in the concentration of THC is it'll go all over the place until people are figuring out what they do. But again, the people that are doing things right are working on this stuff in the back end, even if it's not regulated. When they hold themselves to a higher standard than the regulators are doing it, those are the brands that you should be looking at and sticking with.
Right. The problem is that consumers don't really know that.
I know. But then, so like, if you want to take this to a medical physician, like, that's the kind of stuff that we should have some kind of different class, if that makes sense.
Almost. Yeah,
like,
I know exactly what you're talking about. Because we have that for herbal products, yep. Right? So I need I'm vitamin D deficient. So I need to buy vitamin D. So how do I know that vitamin D really has the same 500,000 you know, 5,000 units it says it does, and it doesn't have very contaminant. There's a USP seal, which is a voluntary national standard that a lot of brands don't bother with, but some do. And so I make sure that if I buy any supplements, it has a USP seal.
And so a lot of times, some of those supplements too, I'm not trying to trash supplements, but I'm thinking that too. It's going to be alarming too, because like, if supplements become not a non-quantifiable thing, or like they're adding ashwagandha or something, like not an actual analyte, a lot of that thing is the lab's responsibility. It's called confirmed by input. So all they do is they say, do my math for me and check. And I don't like that industry because of that. I don't like to play on doing a lab work by checking someone's math to say you're right. So if the items in the pharma, or excuse me, the herbal industry are being confirmed by input, it doesn't mean anything either.
Wait, are you like saying that my vitamin D may be
no? I'm not saying anything about my USP stuff. No,
that's it. But wait, I'm not as worried about my vitamin D. I'm worried more about that USP seal, it means you've paid a lot more money to get that seal on your product.
The USP seal. So I wasn't talking about the vitamin D stuff like that. But when you get to those new exotic herbals that are coming into the markets, like, you know, like ashwagandha or this.
Right,
or that,
right. I can't trust that.
You can't. And then that's why you have things like the USP seal. But why don't we have a USP seal on cannabis, or, you know, something that says, oh, they went the extra mile for edibles. They check consistency testing over big lot batches, and they have a tight range.
Is there any talk about, from the reputable distributors, to have a USP seal?
Yes.
Okay. And is it the same USP? Because at least that one,
it's
I know
not
I
USP
trust.
Seal. They're working on their own. It's so that the industry.
But then I've seen them just put their own like fake label.
I know. And that's what I've been trying to work with people and like kind of develop something.
That's why the USP is that's nationally recognized. If you went through that, then I could at least trust it.
Yeah. I mean, we can work on things like the USP. I mean, I know some people there. So it's just, it's hard. And then the problem is too, it's not a problem, but like the cannabis industry as itself is struggling because of the dichotomy of good actors, bad actors. We want to say it that way. I don't want to point fingers at people, but it's like people doing things right and going above and beyond to do testing and making sure it's a quality product, and the people pay, I can just slide this through and the price point's this much lower and you can't, you know, you have that problem. Then the people that want to do this USP seal, it's going to cost them a lot of money. And now you get what I'm saying? You're adding more and more expense on someone that's already drowning in not being able to be profitable because they can't do it right.
What do you think about potencies? Like, you know, you were talking about some of the vape crowds are like 90% potency. How could that be safe?
I don't think it's unsafe. I think it's the same thing that you're saying with flower. I mean, any of this stuff you can definitely.
But that's just like we have that with medicine, right? We can't. I'm not. You know, we've come to terms that like 240 milligrams of oxycodone is probably not safe. Right? We have standards on that, right?
Yep. I mean, that has a lot to do with tolerance and everything else. But I agree with what you're saying with 240 milligrams. But not every compound shares that same. You know.
90% THC. It's being sold now legally. Let's say it's pure with no contaminants, but it's 90% THC. How could that be safe? How could that be?
Why is it unsafe?
Because of the potency and the risk of psychosis and the harms that we're seeing.
So, I mean, the other part too is when you inhale any of this cannabis stuff, you're not getting 100% of it, right? So leave that 90% and you're vaporizing a small amount of it. It would be a smaller amount that you're ingesting. And if you don't hold it in, things like that, there's a lot of things. Yes, you can do it and you could make it so you're consuming massive amounts of it. But it goes back to the thing, 90% potency is like the flower compared to an edible, right? We were talking about before, you can't go backwards on an edible. When you smoke flower, we think we can stop and that they have also 30% flower, let's call it, or 25 or whatever it is. It's the same thing as a distillate pen. People are just consuming a lot less of it.
The people who said it's not safe is the FDA, right? That we're holding to, you know, our national gold standard, right? And they did the studies with Marinol, with pure THC, and they came up with a safety limit, which is way less than what any of the cannabis industry is using. But like if I prescribe Marinol, then the FDA label says maximum 20 milligrams.
Is it for inhalation?
It's oral. It's a pill.
Yeah, so that's different then. We're talking about inhalation.
Okay.
Okay.
So that's why.
Well, inhaling anything is not probably safe, right?
Yeah,
right?
I mean, so I don't think anyone's really done the inhalation studies to do this. There are people working, actually, I think Allison Justice does some stuff on that, Marcus Rogan. But to take this back, like, I don't think it's necessarily unsafe. It's like saying that you know drinking. I know I hate comparing this kind of stuff, but okay, then liquor's 100% unsafe. No one should be able to consume any liquor because it's that much more concentrated than beer. But sure, if you chug the whole bottle of liquor, it's going to be unsafe, right? But if you take one shot of liquor or something like that, so it's like that kind of, at least analogy of, you want to say liquor. I hate comparing things like that, but I don't think it's necessarily going to be unsafe proven. That'd be a whole thing. Vaporizing, there's a million possibilities of things being unsafe. But I don't think having that concentrated of a sample would make it unsafe compared to safe. If we're going to say flour would be safe.
But so I'm going to like argue with you just because it's fun. But we started this conversation saying that it's the burden of proof of safety should come first versus the other way around. But now we're kind of saying bake. It's like, oh, well, who said it's not safe? Like, shouldn't we prove it's safe first? Are you familiar with the Bryn Spacer case in Thousand Oaks? She had a date with her boyfriend and took a puff, and I'd be saying it not exactly right, but he had a big bong on her table and she took a puff and it didn't do anything for her, and he did something to it and then said, okay, do it now. And she took another puff and instantly developed cannabis-induced psychosis. She stabbed him 108 times, killed him, stabbed herself, stabbed her door. And now if you looked at her now, she looks normal, but she had this, you know, obvious horrible reaction. And she is not an inexperienced user. She's used marijuana a few times in the past, but that potency costs somebody's life.
Yeah, I'm not 100% aware of that case, and I would like to look into it. But I understand what you're saying with the onus of being unsafe or safe. So then what are you saying? Then no one should be smoking anything concentrated. And then where's the concentration limit? There's no study on it, right? So then all inhalable cannabis should be not available. I understand what you're saying with that. And then the other part is, like, you can go look at states that are doing similar things. So is it Oklahoma? No, not Oklahoma. Who just, Ohio? The maximum THC percentage in vaporizers is 40%. Mm-hmm. Is that correct?
I'm not sure.
Me on that. Yeah. Don't quote me on the state. There's one of the states just came out with that. The scary part is now they're taking concentrate and then diluting it down. They're diluting it down with pollutants that aren't necessarily safe. That's another study that we did. We did a study looking at pollutants that they're using in the cannabis space. And then the people are diluting things with MCT oil or other pollutants. MCT oil shouldn't be vaporized, inhaled. You eat MCT oil all day, but it won't get processed out through your lungs. Vitamin E acetate. Remember that whole thing? That was a pollutant used to make more money. But again,
by the way, what happened with that is, are people not using that vitamin D acetate anymore? Is that how come it went away?
It's so it came in and went pretty quick because it started killing children. People were very scared. I'll tell you this, a couple weeks ago, a few hemp samples came through my lab, not to be like tested, but for screening for different purposes, that had 50% vitamin D acetate in it being sold at gas stations.
Yeah. So that's still happening.
It's still happening. Not as big and not as prevalent. But it is. And that's one of those things is I understand.
Why do people use that? Is it cheap? Is that why?
Cheaper. So if I told you, you know, use half the active ingredient that costs you the most money and fill it up the same thing, but it costs you a penny to fill up the rest of the way. That's all they're doing. They're, you know, doubling their profit. They say it's a, you know, higher percentage of THC or something. And they just go ahead and they cut it in half, and they, you know, cutting it in half is cheaper. So they're just like stomping on it or whatever they say. I don't know. Doubling their money. They do it because it's cost and they're just trying to make more money. I understand what you're saying with the onus to prove safety of concentrates would be a whole thing. I mean, that it's a big ask on that. I mean, I don't 100% agree, and I can respectfully disagree with anyone that necessarily the vaporizers are going to be the unsafe thing of this industry or anything else. The concentrates, in my opinion, are not going to be.
What is?
The untested stuff, the stuff passing through, it's the contaminants in this industry are the problems for long-term health. The psychosis stuff, I think that's a whole thing. That is a problem, and that can be independently a problem. And that kind of stuff happens with everything. So someone could drink a little bit of alcohol or a little bit more, and then you can have that kind of issues. I mean, those are real.
No, alcohol is water soluble. It won't give you instant psychosis. People who develop psychosis from alcohol, it's after years of use, or they're, you know, they get Wernicke's Korsakoff psychosis. But you're not going to use, there's no, I don't know another, like a legal product where
so you're saying people don't get so drunk they get in cars and drive around and they make
decisions. Yes. Absolutely. You make that bad decision, it affects your perception, your gait, your speech. We all know that. But you're not going to all of a sudden think that you're dead and you need to stab your boyfriend 100 times in order to come back to life from getting drunk.
I mean, how many cases that go on compared to the number of consumption of that?
Yeah, and then depends on potency. I mean, but actually, enough is happening of that. And we have, like, the saddest podcast I've ever done was a bunch of parents who've lost their children because of that, right? And we're not seeing that. That's my whole thing.
Is
that you need to be an informed decision maker. And the public is not, when it comes to marijuana and these products, they're not informed decision. If you're smoking, if you're drinking alcohol, then you're making an informed decision. And I don't think the public at this point in time is making informed decisions when it comes to these products.
I think that's an important step, is informed decisions. I hear what you say with the parents on any kid that's horrible. And I think that's not right. And this goes back to a topic that we talked about too, though, is anything being done accurately? So let's just say I'm just making it up, that 90% vape pen, it was really THCP or something else, or, you know, it has something else in it. And that's what caused the psychosis for that one specific person. It wasn't actually the Delta-9 THC. I mean, this is the problem, is we don't really have this testing regime to blame it on one or the other. And I understand what you're saying, that it needs to be.
And as a doctor, I'm not going to know the answer to that. I'm just going to be able to say, wow, this happened to you. You need to stop using this, whatever this is, so you could get your brain back and have a normal life. Right, because I won't be able to get to that type of detail.
I agree. I mean, abuse of any compound or any one thing is horrible. I mean, anything. You can drink too much water. You can drink too much caffeine. It's like the moderation of anything you do should be taken into account for everything. And I think that's cannabis use too.
I was an expert witness one time for somebody who drank too much and died in jail because just from water. Yeah, just from water. Now, they weren't a regular person. They have underlying, you know, schizophrenia and medications that make you more susceptible to hyponatremia from drinking too much. But yeah, he died from water.
But I mean, could that be the case in the court case that you're talking about, the lady killing someone?
No, except we're seeing that more often. I see that in the emergency room, right?
You are seeing it a lot.
Yeah, we are.
Do you trace it back to like what product they're using?
I can't do that.
I don't know. Yeah, I know it's hard.
I can't. And with the Bryn Spacer case, it would be interesting to know, to get your intake on that, because they tested her, you know, and she just had THC in her body, nothing else. And they tested the bong, and they found only THC in the body. But I wonder, because I know that there's more to it than that, if they tested for these other Delta products or whatever, if the library was big enough. And I have no idea. Maybe she did. And maybe the bong did, and nobody actually tested. Yeah.
100%. So I don't know if you read there's another LA Times thing recently about the all the psychosis bars. The mushroom bars and chocolate.
Yeah, today, right? It came out.
It might have came out today. It might have came out last week. I do a lot of work. We work with hospitals on this because they keep getting kids in OD. And that this was like a side project. This kind of came before that project with LA Times. But the San Diego hospitals, they kind of reached out with an organization. We were talking to them. And they're like, well, these kids show up and they have these chocolates and says no psychedelics in it. And they're freaking out. They're ODing. We don't even know what to do with them. What's in it? It says nothing illegal. There's no problem. And then we started getting him and inquiring him and doing all this testing. And like,
good for you, and good for the hospital for thinking of reaching out to you.
Yeah. So I mean, it's always I end up in these things and organizations. I try to, honestly, free work, public safety. This is what we do, and we do this, and we made these categories. Like, if you see this, this is what's in it, and this is maybe the way you should treat. Figure it out. I'm not going to tell you how to treat it. It's not my job. I'm just going to tell you what's in it. But the interesting part is, if most like criminal labs started testing these, they would say nothing's in it. Why disease are
because they're not in their library, right? That's what I was thinking when it came to her.
That's a cool instrument I was reading before. We bought these things called Orbitraps. They're high resolution mass spectrometers. You can do this. It's something called unknown unknown analysis, where you start looking for things that no one looks at or you're not telling it to look for. And we can scan these large databases of complex matrices, or like an edible with random things in it, and start choosing out what we find in them. And then we can qualify and quantify them. So we do all the time. I love doing this stuff. But then we find, oh, look, they're not even using psilocybin. They're using these derivatives of psilocybin that you would miss if you were just looking with your blinders on, the same thing as the pesticide. So when we go back to that case we just talked about, I would love to get a sample of that product.
I would want you to also, and her, because I'm wondering if it was some of these other things that caused this terrible reaction.
How long after they test her? Because some of these psychedelics go in and out in 20 minutes or in a day, less than a day, you're not going to be able to detect it in blood. And if they're not looking for that specific psychedelic metabolite, good luck. So these the number of psychedelics that are going into the stream now, right, of non-traditional, not traditional, but like the things we saw in the past, LSD, mushroom, psilocybin, all that, there's so many thousands of derivatives getting made in bathtubs and put in products. It's insane. It's the same thing as when you look at fentanyl. It's not just one compound. There's thousands of derivatives of fentanyl. And guess what? A long time ago, if you were analyzing for fentanyl, you would be looking at these little lists. Now they keep getting bigger and bigger. So how much stuff have they missed in the past? That's the thing, is like when we start saying this is a cause of this, and we're not actually looking at it as a big picture, it might not be. And I'm not saying it wasn't or it is. I always say you want to definitely put the research and work into it to make sure we're cute or saying this is the fault of this, to make sure that's what it was. But that was a really good example of like putting this all back together. It's like we did this and we were finding some of these mushroom bars or chocolates, some other.
This is how you and I got connected, because there was Dawn, shout out to Dawn from Say San Diego, who came to me and she goes, "What is being sold next to schools? Look at these products." And I said, I agree. I want to know. I want to tell the medical community. I want to tell my colleagues what our patients are using. And we went to law enforcement and they wouldn't do it for us. So she found you.
Yeah. I mean, this is the kind of stuff we do. I mean, we work with various companies. I mean, the DEA won't give us a license in cannabis. We touch cannabis, but we work with people in the law enforcement to do this kind of stuff because it's important. And that's the thing, is like, until we stop missing the analytes that we're looking for, we'll never know. I mean, we found stuff, I think in this study with Dawn, we found psilocybin, MDMA.
Yeah, there were some, it was pretty outrageous. And I didn't know what some of the chemicals were. Like, so some of them were DMT. What is that?
So Dan, it's a derivative of a psychedelic. So if you ever, there's literally thousands of psychedelics that act very similar to like psilocybin and LSD, and they'll act in very similar matters. The DMT, those 4-acetyl-DMT, there's other ones, forms of it too. It's just that thing where they start changing out the little C groups, or your groups on your compounds, and make them your functional groups, and make them so they don't test. It's remember, what was the walking zombie people? It was bath salts. Remember the bath salt crisis thing?
Yeah. I remember. We treated people. They like they looked like they were on PCP. That's kind of.
Yeah. So the baths, you know how they kept selling it? All they did was change, add another like carbon hydrogen to it. And then now it's not illegal because it's a different compound. And you would have the same effect. And this is like the thing, chasing down these.
Wait, is that what DMT is? Is that what you were calling? Because in the LA Times article, it says we found bath salts in that. Is that what the DMT is?
No, that was different. That was actually a bath salt compound. We found a lot of different things in there. Those are all bought at one
sold store, to too. Children with cartoon characters. What about muscimol? Is that a legal mushroom?
Muscimol? No, that would be illegal. But so a lot of times the functional mushrooms, so we did the project with that. I did a presentation at the, I think it was 2023 psychedelic conference in Denver of the functional mushroom one, because there are a lot of people with benefits, functional mushrooms. I've sat there with mothers of children crying because the functional mushroom their kids take me, making them functional again. I mean, I'm just telling you, I've sat there and it's amazing to see these stories, but then you ask yourself, what's really changing here? And then the scary part is, why I kind of did this, I wanted to look like, is there really something there? And a lot of the functional mushrooms they're actually just fake, or they'll put in a psychedelic thing or something like that. So it's a whole broken system with a broken testing industry, and that it scares me. It's the same type of situation you see in like
it Canada should scare you. And if it scares you, it should scare everybody.
But I mean, there are a lot of analytical problems out there, and you can't solve them all, but definitely working towards it. But that's why, like, I take a step back in a lot of things, when like the cannabinoid psychosis, and like looking at it, and I really want to know that's the truth. Because I feel like we're going to end up judging something or blaming something. Potentially, maybe we're looking at it, but maybe that vaporizer had THCP in or HHC or these other things, or one of these hallucinogenics. You get what I'm saying? But because they bought it from a legal hemp industry, or that's why I asked that question. Do you ever try to trace it back to the brand and the product? And I know that's a very hard ask or tell, but I mean, the guy put more something into a bong, and then she smoked it again.
Yeah, I was disappointed that the testing didn't go as far as I know to see that. Like, I would have loved to have seen the lab or who did that. Or
I would almost bet everything. My perspective is they took that, ran an extensive list of testing on the normal things found for narcotics, and that list is this big. And the list of possible narcotics is the size of my house. You understand what I'm saying?
Yes.
And that's a problem. Unless you start doing this unknown screening and trying to dial in to find this stuff, which, to tell the truth, is very extensive and hard work. And you need very qualified people and very expensive equipment. And not a lot of state labs are doing that. Because a lot of times with these state labs, it's a court case. It's very quick. It has to get done. And it's a very small amount of pay.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the reality.
Right. That's what I wonder. But actually, they did more than most trials did, because they tested her and the bong. So I think that's.
But that's the thing, what are they looking for? You test her and the bong, and they're looking for a standard list.
Yeah, I think they probably went, I imagine, and I don't know, that they went through the standard list. And today's standard list does not match the products that are out there. That's the problem.
Yeah, that's what we were looking at, the mushroom study and everything else, because I mean, I've talked to some state labs, and they're intrigued with some of the stuff we're finding. We're passing it along to them. They're like, oh, that's not on my list of things I'm screening for. Maybe we should add that. I'm like, yeah, maybe you should.
Yeah, that's interesting. So who are your customers? You said your customers are like state of California, state of Michigan.
No, not the state. The state. So my customers are the people that produce the material in the state. For the cannabis and hemp industry, it's the people that are legal producers in the respective states. So are my customers. My opinion, my real customers are the public. And that's why, like, we don't waver on any kind of analytical passing, failing of anything.
What if a parent found some bag of cookies or whatever that they're worried about for the parent? Can they come to you? Do you have private customers too?
100%. I can take samples in from the general public. And right. I do. And a lot of those times I don't consider them my customers, because I actually probably don't eat too much testing and care too much when I hear these stories of people. And I do over and above and don't charge hardly anything.
So, and you know what? Oftentimes I'll have a patient who's, you know, intubated or really psychotic. And very rarely do I actually find the product. But a few times I found the product, and I'll, you know, ask security or law enforcement, well, what is this? Should we test it? And they'll be like, oh, that's probably just spice, and nobody really cares.
I'll do it. Give it to me for free. If you ever are interested and you find it again, you can legally hand it to me. I will gladly give you the reports, and I will not charge you a dollar to better science and better understanding.
Wow. I did one time, people say, is there any fentanyl in marijuana? And we haven't had any cases like that in California, because if we do, that is a serious public health, you know, alert that we need to put out. But one time I had a patient who came in and he required multiple doses of naloxone. I actually had to admit him because of a fentanyl overdose. And he was like, no, it's just my marijuana. It's just my marijuana. And he had a vape pen, and it looked like it came from a name brand. I don't remember what it was now. And I was thinking, wow, what if this has, you know, what if this is a marijuana brand that really has fentanyl in it? And it had fentanyl, no THC. And he also tested on his body only fentanyl, no THC. And so in his mind, he thought he was using marijuana.
That's the scary part. And like, you go into the illicit market, and like, these things are, they'll look the exact same as the legal market. They'll put them in pretty packaging. They'll put stamps on them. It exactly looks the same. You understand what I'm saying? You go into some of those illicit shops, it looks like you're in a legal shop in the cannabis industry, but they just put whatever they want. I've actually done this one time. I got a report from someone that really wanted to help. And it was the same type of situation, like this illicit dispensary in this city, I'm trying to stay away from things, is selling cannabis flower laced with fentanyl. So I went in there and I bought it myself and took it back to my lab. Maybe that's illegal, maybe it's not. I don't care. If I'm going to go down for protecting the public, that's what I go down for. And I went and tested for fentanyl. I didn't have it in that one specific case. But I went and I investigated it for them because that's a big thing. Didn't one state just get caught up with fentanyl and marijuana?
There have been, I don't know if it was Michigan, but there have been public health alerts. Yes.
One of them was just found, I think it was found by the crime lab. And this was recent, probably in the last 2 weeks. There's so much news with this stuff, it's hard to
get. Yeah. There have been a couple states. I do follow that. I don't remember which states. I don't want to get it wrong. But yeah. I know that he hasn't come to California yet. So, yeah. But I'm always, looking out for that. Well, that's amazing. So what do you think of the fact that people call you like the whistleblower in the cannabis industry? But you seem that you are the protector, not the whistleblower.
People call me a lot of things. People call me a lot of negative things. Not a lot of people call me positive.
But don't call me late for dinner.
If it's a whistleblower, if protecting the public is what I'm seeing as a bad thing for, or potentially saving someone's life one day, then I'm a whistleblower. Then I'm the rat. I'm whatever you want to call me. I don't care. And that doesn't bother me. But if that's what you're going to define it as, please let people know you think people are bad people that are protecting people. But I don't know how many people are going to like you better. That's the truth. It's been a lot for the last year or two.
I see that you are like this mad genius, and your brother saw that in you years ago, and you're kind of like running with it in all sorts of ways. I am really happy we had this conversation, and I hope it continues because we applied to speak at the National RX Summit. It's usually just about fentanyl, and they like to not talk about marijuana, but we put in to talk about these mushrooms and what we're finding, and I think the National Summit should care about that, but we'll find out. But if we do, we'll get to hang out in person.
Yeah, I think those emerging markets, I don't want to call emerging market, but the emerging problem coming up, and it scares you, and it can become bigger problems if we don't look at it now. Yeah.
And I think that you see that more than everyone because you're because you love your toys and you have this, and you go beyond just checking what you're, on the checkoff list. You really want to know what's out there.
Yeah, I really want to make sure stuff's safe and people aren't going to kill themselves by doing this stuff. And that's what the mushroom thing has always bugged me, because you look at the packaging and it's like to donate to children. They tell you nothing's wrong with it and you're not going to get high off of it. But that's exactly what it is. And it's like, it's you're running into a wall with that. I mean, if people want to say there's a good side to psychedelics and all the research they put into it and for the medical field, we kill these things by allowing this to live as well. So if there is, I'm not claiming there is or isn't, but there's a lot of research that goes into that.
And I agree with you. And I just think it kills my whole profession. If you don't follow the standards of medical care, FDA process and studies, you can't say something's good based on one child whose parents.
One child it worked for and then doesn't work for other ones. And then you have it. Yeah, I 100% agree. That's why we sometimes put our best foot forward and we all do what we can to make this a better place. Yeah.
Thank you, Josh. You're incredible. This has been a great, enlightening conversation. I bet I'm going to be staying in touch with you.
Definitely. If you ever need anything, I'm always here to help. Always, if you have any questions, glad to answer. And then send any emails over to me. I have some other great staff and people that I work with that make me as even better than I am today. So
that's awesome. Thank you so much. Thank you for listening to High Truths on Drugs and Addiction, where you learn from experts from around the globe and around all aspects of drugs and addiction. This week's episode would not be possible without the generous support of our sponsor. A sincere and warm thank you to Physicians for Healthy Communities. Visit physiciansforhealthycommunities.org and view their video and resource library. High Truth's producer is Dave Rivas from Davey Boy Productions. I'm your host, Dr. Ronit Lev. We hope we brought your day a little bit more high truths.